Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. Next, University of Maryland professor Richard Bell looks at the British occupation of colonial Boston. In October of 1768, a fleet of warships carrying British infantry regiments anchored in Boston Harbor. The troops were sent to reassert Britain's control over the increasingly disloyal colony and to ensure the correct amount of taxes were collected and sent to Britain. This lecture is 40 minutes.
October the 1st, 1768, a fleet of British warships dropped anchor in Boston Harbor. And later that same day, three regiments of British infantry marched ashore from those ships, with their drums beating, their bayonets fixed, and their flags streaming behind them. The soldiers marched up Boston's Long Wharf, past the shops and warehouses piled up along the waterfront, and they stopped outside the townhouse, the colony's main government building, surrounding that government building in an intimidating show of force. Now, over the next year and a half, as many as 2,000 British troops would occupy the city of Boston. Why they were there, what impact the arrival of a peacetime standing army had on the ordinary people living in this still struggling port city, and why their presence became the source of such extraordinary tension is the subject of today's lecture. Now, if you remember last week's lecture about colonists' response to the Townshend duties, you probably already have a fair idea of why the British government dispatched four of its regiments to the port of Boston in the fall of 1768. So let me pose that to you as a question. Given what you know already, why might the British government post four of its regiments to the city of Boston in the fall of 1768? What's the context here that might lead to that sort of decision? Yes, Ben, let's go to you with the microphone. Yes, Ben.
There had been protests and violence following the taxes that the Parliament had put on the colonists, so they wanted to suppress that and prevent that from happening again.
So to suppress continuing or possibly ongoing violent protest against these Townshend duties is one important thought. Let's go to Brandon.
They wanted to protect their employees that they already had there so they wouldn't get attacked again.
So the British government in London wanted to protect its representatives in Boston. Brandon, who did you have in mind when you said its representatives or agents in Boston?
They're tax collectors.
Tax collectors, okay. Or customs officials more broadly, because the Townshend duties are import taxes. Any other ideas? So protect customs agents, to suppress violent protests, and I think it's John all the way over here. This guy's getting a workout. John.
To use it as a show of force, so not just as a response to these specific revolts, but to say, you know, we are the British Empire, you are our colony, and you will listen to us.
You put that very well. I can't really rephrase that and prove it. You said as a show of force to remind the colonists, who are the colonists and who are the mother country, a show of force. Anyone else? Okay, well, that's largely the same reasons that I wanted to get across to you, so we're all on the same page here already. To my mind, there are three separate yet interconnected reasons to explain the occupation of Boston. The first reason is to protect from harassment those merchants, and this is perhaps the only thing we didn't hear from the audience so far, to protect from harassment those merchants who still refuse to join the non-importation movement that had begun in response to the 1767 Townshend Revenue Acts. Second, and we did hear this, to allow customs inspectors and tax collectors to do their work safely and honestly, thereby reducing smuggling and increasing tax revenue for the cash-starved British Treasury. And third, to reassert British control, and this is combining what John and Ben said, to reassert British control and restore the rule of law to a population increasingly known for its disrespect for symbols of crown or parliamentary authority. Now, the precise timing of the British government's decision to send troops to Boston should probably be attributed to the second of these three imperatives. And what do I mean by that? Well, on June the 10th, 1768, Crown customs officials in Boston had seized a ship docked in the harbor, which was owned by John Hancock, one of the richest merchants in the city. Now, the customs officials who'd seized this ship suspected that Hancock's ship, which was called the Liberty, was being used to smuggle expensive wine from a Portuguese island called Madeira into Boston without it being subject to the proper amount of taxes, that John Hancock wasn't paying the right, correct, legal amount of taxes on the things he was importing, and he was therefore a smuggler. This was therefore a smuggling ship. That was the suspicion. Now, even though this ship, the Liberty, had almost certainly been engaged in precisely the sort of smuggling that I just described, most townsfolk, when they heard of the customs officials' attempt to seize the Liberty, to impound it, sided with the ship's owner, with John Hancock, with the suspected smuggler. As soon as the customs officials returned from impounding the ship, a crowd of between 500 and 1,000 townsfolk attacked those customs officials, pummeling them with clumps of dirt, with stones, and with other projectiles. And the same crowd then followed these petrified customs agents to their homes, where the crowd broke these men's windows and burned to ashes a little rowboat that one of the customs officials owned and was very, very, very proud of. 2 days later, these terrified customs officials, who were just trying to do their job, at least I would argue that, fled the city of Boston, intimidated by the crowd's response to them trying to do their work. So a question: why do you think ordinary people in the city of Boston, perhaps as many as 1,000 of them, might have been eager to intervene in the dispute between Crown officials and John Hancock, and not just intervene, but side with the smuggler? Why do you think up to 1,000 ordinary Boston townsfolk might have rushed to the aid of a rich smuggler like John Hancock? Help me understand that. Your name is?
Juliet.
Well, if they stopped buying British goods, they probably wanted whatever John Hancock was smuggling.
So Juliet says if we're in the middle of an import boycott of legally imported goods, then maybe ordinary people are happy to address that imbalance by enjoying whatever smugglers have to offer. John Hancock might be quite a popular man during a boycott of legally imported stuff. That's a great point. Molly, right here.
I think letting the Crown custom officials seize John Hancock's ship represents a much larger issue, which is letting the Crown custom officials rule them. So by letting them seize the ship, it like says that they have control of them.
So, okay, so this is again a sort of protest about Crown authority. Here we have the representatives of the Crown trying to flex their muscles, show John Hancock, one of the richest guys in the city, who's boss, therefore show the whole of Boston who's a boss, who's the boss. Ordinary people saying, not so much, right? Slow down here. Okay. And Alex, right here.
John Hancock was a very powerful and influential person in Boston, so a lot of the townsfolk might have seen him as a symbol of resistance against the British, and they saw this as an attack on not just him, but on all of them.
So one thing I'll take from that is that we know from previous work in this class that John Hancock is indeed one of the leaders of organized resistance against British authority, right? We saw him last week trying to lure the leader of the Boston mob, Ebenezer Hancock, to sort of do his bidding, bribing Ebenezer Hancock, that's my word, with a new uniform, with a free meal to get him to go protest the Stamp Act, I think it was, and its implementation a couple of years ago. So there's already a connection between the Boston mob and John Hancock, and that connection comes through protests against the British Crown. That's terrific. So, to Francis Bonar, the royal governor of Massachusetts, this attack on the persons and property of Crown officials was the last straw. For the past year, Governor Barnard had watched helplessly as local people undermined the Townshend Revenue Acts by boycotting imported goods and by organizing into homespun associations. Now, Governor Barnard fired off letters to London, begging them, begging the Parliament there for troops to come to Boston to garrison, to put a stop to the sort of nonsense they'd seen with those customs officials' houses being attacked. On July 30th, the Secretary of State in London, the Earl of Hillsborough, received Governor Barnard's plea, and in response, he dispatches 4 infantry regiments with orders, and here's the quote, with orders to use such force as you shall think necessary to prevent Boston from boiling over into what they saw as total lawlessness and insurrection. Now, when word spread that 4 British regiments were on their way, Bostonians erupted in anger. They understood immediately that they were now being treated as enemy combatants who must be suppressed with force. This is a strange thing to do to your own people, right? To send troops out there to enforce order. But there were also other reasons to be furious. For one thing, most newspaper-reading colonists understood that sending expensive regiments to Boston was a way for the British government to pass along the cost of maintaining these regiments to New Englanders. What do I mean by that? Some context is useful here. 3 years earlier, in 1765, the colonial papers had been filled with news of a new law known as the Quartering Act, a law that decreed that local hosts must now supply the needs and pay the costs of any regiments quartered in their communities. So if the if an army regiment comes to Boston, comes to Scotland, comes to wherever it might be, it is the local community that will pay for their upkeep. So to many conspiracy-minded Bostonians, the decision in 1768 to send 4 of these expensive-to-maintain regiments to subdue their little city was simply an excuse for the British government to save money. That's one reason they're annoyed. I think these troops have arrived in part to save the British government some money. Now, look at it from the British point of view for a second. Might there be some other reasons beyond saving some cash why the British government might be interested in garrisoning some of its regiments in far-flung parts of its empire like Boston? Boston, of course, is more than 3,000 miles away from London. Why leave all your troops out there? Why leave some of your troops there? What might be some other reasons beyond saving some cash for garrisoning troops in places like Boston? Any thoughts? Yes, what's your name?
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth? Let's hold on a second. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
To build loyalty to the British Empire.
How does garrisoning troops in your backyard build your loyalty?
Well, they're not going to like act up against the Empire if there's a troop in their house.
Okay.
Yeah.
So to ensure order is what you're saying. Okay. Maybe order, maybe peacefulness might lead to loyalty later on. That's a possibility. Other reasons why the British government might post pockets of troops around the corners of its empire?
It's a port, so any kind of port you want to keep protected, especially with like France and Spain at war with them. So
you're saying Boston is a valuable asset because it's a port, a center of trade, and in particular, there might be other European powers who might want to acquire somewhere like Boston, particularly if people in Boston are doubting their loyalty to England. So the threat of France and Spain, and you've seen that play out in the Seven Years' War a few years earlier. Thank you. Yes, what's your name?
Patricia. In order to get like intel from like the colonists and what they plan to do later in the future.
Great, I couldn't put it better myself. You said to gather intelligence information about what these protests are all about, whether they're serious and a long-term threat to the solidity of the British Empire or not. Any other thoughts? We'll go right here. What's your name?
Amanda. Like we said before, to remind the colonists that their power can still reach across the ocean, like physically, and not just the acts that they've been sending over.
Okay, so again, a show of force. I'll take that. Let me put the question this way. Why might the British government be interested in dispersing some of its troops away from Britain?
Spencer? to cast a wide net of their military influence, because right now the British Empire spans the entire globe. If they need to have troops, say, in South America or in other parts of the Western Hemisphere, they could easily move their troops if they're from what's now the United States.
So to better respond to whatever international crises may come up is what I heard Spencer say. Anyone heard of the threat of standing armies? Anyone know why people would be upset about having large numbers of troops back in Britain all at once? Was there someone? Brandon? Yep.
Does it have anything to do with the job market out there?
Tell me, does it?
Maybe if there's too many troops back home, then they're going to take up all the jobs.
Oh, okay. So troops who are moonlighting, looking for secondary jobs, may compete with British people who are civilians. I'll take that. Who's this?
Lauren.
Right here, Lauren.
A lot of times, like, if you have a standing army, like, whoever's the leader of that can be, like, a power that can be in competition with the king. So if he moves out more troops, then it moves out support for, like, the head of the army.
So Lauren said that having large numbers of troops who follow a military hierarchy is great, provided that hierarchy responds to the civilians in charge of the military, the king, the prime minister, whoever it might be, the Secretary of Defense in the modern United States, right? But what if the army stops responding to the Secretary of Defense or the president, or in England, in this place, the king and the prime minister? Then you've got a coup on your hands, right? So keeping some of your soldiers at arm's length may reduce the possibility that your own country falls into rebellion or civil war or there's a coup. And a lot of people in Britain have long had a fear of having too many troops standing around at home. They don't know what they're going to do next. So that's one reason that people in Boston are angry. They think that they've been sent these troops just so Britain can save some money or disperse its troops away from its core. More worryingly, Bostonians already had a good idea of what to expect once these regiments arrived in their local community. Ever since the Stamp Act riots of 1765 and 1766, a couple of years earlier, nearby New York City had been home to 1,000 redcoats. And if the Boston newspapers were to be believed, those soldiers had caused nothing but trouble there in New York a couple of years earlier. Back then, in July 1766, for instance, the papers had described how four drunken British officers had stumbled back to base from a night drinking in a New York tavern, smashing 34 street lamps on their way home and attacking with swords anyone who tried to stop them. When some Manhattan watchmen had finally challenged them, a street brawl had broken out between the Manhattan watchmen and the drunken British officers, in which several watchmen were stabbed and two redcoat officers were beaten. No surprise, then, that New Yorkers had tried everything to get rid of those soldiers when they were garrisoned in New York City in 65 and 66. As one Manhattan paper, the New York Gazette, had put it in 1766, the people in general here in New York City are very uneasy that such a number of armed men, without any visible occasion for them here, are stationed among us and suffered to patrol the streets as if in a military or conquered town. Why are these troops here? What have we done? Why are we being treated as if we are a foreign country that has been invaded and conquered? We are part of the British Empire. Start treating us like that. That's what these New Yorkers are saying when they're occupied in 65, 66. By November 68, all four regiments had arrived in Boston, and Boston, too, had become, like New York before it, a conquered town. In fact, with 2,000 redcoats occupying a city in which only 3,000 residents were men over the age of 16, men of fighting age, it was suddenly the fact that 2 out of 5 adult men in Boston were soldiers. The redcoats were everywhere. And almost immediately, they started making enemies. Take their housing, for instance. Governor Barnard had at first proposed that the old city workhouse, a big two-story building known as the Manufactory House, could be converted into a barracks for these arriving troops. But although it was no longer in use as a workhouse by 1768, the Manufactory House was not actually empty. Several squatters, all of them poor, and several of them ill, occupied the premises. and they would have to be forcibly removed to make way for the soldiers. So in a disastrous early move for the military's public relations, on October the 19th, 1768, Governor Barnard instructed the Boston sheriff to clear the building, to empty the manufactory house of its squatters, many of whom are poor or ill. However, the residents inside refused to budge, claiming Barnard's order was illegitimate. To try to force them out, the sheriff broke in, entering through a small cellar window. But once he was inside, the residents took the sheriff hostage. And in the end, it took a party of soldiers to break in to rescue him. It's becoming quite the nightmare here. By the afternoon, the soldiers had laid a full-scale siege to the manufactory house to try to force the eviction of the poor and sick people inside. As the Boston Gazette reported the next day, and this is some bad publicity if ever you wanted it, as the Boston Gazette reported the next day, Friday morning, bread and water were denied to the occupants inside the manufactory house. The siege goes on. And no person allowed to speak to those inside for several hours. The sick inside were denied the visits of their physicians, and Dr. Church's apprentice in the afternoon had several pushes with a bayonet as he was attempting to convey them medicines. There are sick people inside this besieged manufactory house. They're being denied their medicines as a way to starve them out. This is terrible publicity for the occupying British Army, who are there hopefully to occupy these barracks if they can be cleared. But this publicity is too bad. Only after such bad press did Governor Barnard call off the siege and instruct the soldiers to forget about the manufactory house as a barracks and instead set up camp in some empty warehouses elsewhere in town instead. As you might imagine, the British soldiers themselves took very little satisfaction being cast in the role of oppressors. In truth, most of the ordinary British soldiers hated their time in Boston. That should be no surprise to us. They were thousands of miles away from home, remember, and they were outnumbered by the locals, most of whom bitterly resented the very fact of these men's presence in their city. And there was nothing romantic about putting on that red uniform and serving king and country in the 1760s. Most of these enlisted men had joined up solely because their own economic survival had demanded that they do something big, join the army or starve. Before becoming infantry regulars in the British Army, most enlisted men had been unemployed manual laborers or artisans who couldn't find steady work in their hometowns back in England. The army was their only lifeline. And even after several years in the army, most of the enlisted men who arrived in Boston in the fall of 1765 were still very much on the hard edge of poverty. Too poor to have gotten married, too poor to support a wife while you were a regular infantry soldier, too poor to have saved anything that you might ever retire on. Their work guarding government buildings and the Boston Customs House was not only incredibly repetitive, unimaginative, and unfulfilling, it was also dangerous, and it was also very hard. Enlisted soldiers garrisoned in Boston worked 9-hour days and spent their off hours trying to earn extra money by hiring themselves out to local businesses as an extra pair of hands. This is called moonlighting, when you take on a second job in addition to your first. For instance, we know that a soldier named Patrick Dines hustled a job in a wig maker's shop. And we know that other enlisted men found employment with rope makers or did a variety of odd jobs along the docks. There are always odd jobs to be done on a waterfront. While some local business owners were surely grateful for the cheap labor that these British soldiers represented, longtime residents, of course, bitterly resented the increased competition for work that these soldiers represented, and they let the Redcoats know that in no uncertain terms. For these reasons, then, life as an enlisted soldier in occupied Boston was a daily grind and a fundamentally depressing experience. Lonely and bored, most found solace either in cheap rum or in cheap local women. Many others deserted the British Army entirely. In fact, desertion was a major problem from day one of the occupation, and at least 40 regular soldiers deserted within 2 weeks of arriving. They take this horrible journey 3,000 miles across the ocean. The welcome they get from local residents is so bad that 40 of them disappear into the Massachusetts countryside and start again. To try to stem that rising tide of desertion from the British ranks, on October the 31st, 1768, the commanding officer, Thomas Gage, you can see him here, had one captured deserter executed by firing squad. General Gage then ordered the regiments to file past the corpse of the would-be deserter and take a good look at what happens to deserters. Yet still, desertions continued to rise. And as a result, much of the Army's daily work consisted of organizing patrols out into the countryside to round up their own deserting men and of posting sentries on the single road out of Boston to try to prevent any further desertions in the weeks and months to come. So when night fell, every person on that single road out of Boston became a suspect, became a potential deserter, forcing the British sentries on that road to challenge everyone they met to see if they were a soldier or a civilian, or face 100 lashes from General Gage for neglecting their duties as sentries. Now, as you might imagine, locals hated these constant inspections by sentries every time they tried to leave town or return to it. In fact, most of the incidents between soldiers and civilians during 1768, that first year of occupation, began that way, as an altercation between civilians and soldiers about who goes there. When a sentry challenged townsmen to identify themselves, townsmen might do a number of things. If there was a group of them trying to pass, trying to get into Boston or out of Boston, and if the local residents, this group, these townsmen, if they were rowdy or drunken, then the townsman sometimes seized the sentry's musket and beat the sentry with his own weapon. If there were too few in number to get away with that, or they were too timid for that sort of thing, townsmen would get the sentry's name and try to have him brought up on charges for shoving his bayonet in their faces and asking them for their papers. Another variation favored by small boys was to throw a rock, a brick, or a snowball at the sentry and then run like hell. Any questions about what I've said so far? I've covered a lot of ground in the last few minutes. We've talked about desertion, why the soldiers are here. Anything on your mind? Nope? Okay. So with soldiers now placed on sentry duty on the road in and out of Boston, and on guard outside the customs house and outside the homes of crown officials, and with British artillery now aimed at the townhouse, the home of the colony's general court, it was easy to understand why many Bostonians felt threatened by this occupation. This new occupying force treated them like second-class subjects, or enemy combatants, as I said earlier on. In fact, it seemed as if everything that these soldiers did got up somebody's nose. Some locals hated how the drumming and the music that accompanied the changing of the guards on Sundays disrupted the solemnity of church services. It's hard to focus on your relationship with God when some soldiers are bashing some drums just down the street. Others hated how the arrival of the redcoats had led more and more young women in town to sell sex to try to make money. Many more hated how some soldiers tried to stir up racial tensions in their town, because, of course, not everyone in Boston is white. For instance, within a month of their arrival in October 1768, three British officers, probably drunk, had been discovered encouraging some African-American slaves in Boston to attack their white masters. One of those drunk officers, Captain John Wilson, had assured these black Bostonians that the soldiers were come here to procure your freedom, and that with your help and assistance, we should be able to drive all the Liberty Boys to the devil. Now, while the slaves he's talking to sensibly ignored these drunken lies, the British Army is not in Boston to free the slaves. Several white residents lodged complaints that Captain Wilson and his probably drunk friends had engaged in a dangerous conspiracy to foment slave rebellion. This sort of talk to enslaved people is dangerous. What the hell are these people thinking? Within a matter of months, altercations between soldiers and townsfolk had become an almost daily fixture of life in this occupied city. And over time, patterns began to emerge in these disputes, which happened over and over again. Patterns that tell us a lot about the experience of occupation for civilians and for soldiers. So I want to pick out over the next few minutes about six of the most important patterns of friction during the occupation. The first thing to notice is that during the occupation of Boston, the British soldiers committed plenty of property crime. Not all the altercations revolve around violence, but there's plenty of property crime committed by the British soldiers too. As soldiers searched for drinking money, they started dabbling in theft and in burglary. For instance, one night, three soldiers stopped a citizen on the street and robbed him of his money after he refused to acknowledge their command. Another night, soldiers burgled a shop and stole some leather from it. While on another occasion, one soldier and two black accomplices broke into a private house and pilfered a variety of silverware. So that's the first thing to notice. A second thing to notice is that the soldiers, most of them single bachelors, by the way, seem to make sport of harassing local women, usually by insulting them or by making lewd comments to them or about them. Occasionally, that harassment even escalated into violence. For instance, one evening, a Boston householder heard two women crying for help. He rushed outside to see what was the matter, only to be met by two soldiers who struck him on his head with the butt of their muskets and told him to mind his business. And they went back to doing whatever it was they were doing to that woman. If the Boston papers were to be believed, local women were also the victims of beatings with cutlasses, with bayonets, with fists and with muskets by British soldiers occupying the city, and victims of the occasional attempted abduction. There's also one newspaper account, and you should listen to this, it's pretty strange. There's also one newspaper account of the attempted rape of an aged, elderly woman who is sitting in her home with her Bible beside her. But if you read that story, you quickly realize that newspaper story is so outrageous, so ridiculous, so monstrous, so obviously evil, that it was probably actually made up by the patriots. Now, why would they do that, just quickly? Why might patriots invent such a story of the rape of an elderly woman with a Bible by her side? She's at home minding her own business, maybe reading the Bible, puts it down, suddenly she's being attacked. That's outrageous, right? Why might patriots possibly have invented a story like that? And your name is?
Jimmy.
Well, they might be trying to incite more people to become angry at the British government and the troops that they've put there.
So it's to make people angry is the general purpose of such an invention, if it's an invention, but it probably was. Okay, so to make more people angry against the British and their proxies here, the soldiers. Can we say anything more? And what's your name?
Sebastian.
It's important to make the colonists look like the humble heroes and to make the British look like the terrible oppressors.
Okay, so British as oppressors and, of course, the colonists as victims here. That they're the target of British monstrosity. And where shall we go next? Should we go down here? What's your name?
Iris.
Iris?
Yeah. To show that no one's safe,
Oh, that's great, to show that no one's safe, that we think of this as being, so far, a conflict, what, about taxes? But yet here, there's an ordinary Boston woman, an aged woman minding her own business, who's got caught up in this growing struggle. That's a really good point. I like that. And yes, your name again?
Beredu. Maybe to reach out to the women, maybe specifically target them to feel sympathy for her and other women, and maybe have them participate more in like the homespun movement and things like that.
So taxes is a pretty dry thing to get excited about. The rape of a neighbor, an elderly woman, could get all sorts of people emotionally involved. Perhaps women have been such an important part of the homespun movement and the other boycotts. But perhaps just to turn what might otherwise be a sort of economic struggle into an emotional struggle more broadly is what one thing I could take from what you said there. So far we've gone through two patterns of friction here. A third thing that the soldiers did a lot of is target the town's own watchmen. Like the redcoat sentries, the town watches were groups of men whose job it was to challenge people out after dark to identify themselves. Now, as you might expect, soldiers, especially officers, took exception to the perceived audacity of ordinary residents, these town's watchmen, demanding to know the identity of soldiers as they're coming and going. So that creates altercations, disputes. In fact, on one night in November 1768, two British officers told members of the Boston Town Watch that they had no right to stop kings, soldiers, and gentlemen who had orders from His Majesty, and that they were above the selectmen who gave them their order. So these soldiers try to pull rank on these Boston watchmen and say, who do you think you are asking us who goes there? And on other occasions, these sort of conversations quickly turn violent. On January the 19th, and the dates aren't important here, on January the 19th, 1769, several officers armed with swords attacked the watch outside of the townhouse, starting a brawl in which one watchman ended up battering an officer with his billhook, which looks pretty nasty. Now, despite all I've said so far about the British soldiers' poor behavior, there was actually plenty of blame to go around, and there were instigators on both sides during the long months of occupation. For one thing, townsfolk would taunt British sentries mercilessly. Bloody-backed scoundrel, lobster, thieving dog, red herring, they would yell at the red coats, right? Lobster back, red herring, red coat. It's all making fun of the dress of these British soldiers, many of them sentries. These are the sort of insults they get. And sometimes those insults, those jibes, have a political dimension to them as well. Damn the king, damn the governor, damn the officers and soldiers is the sort of thing that sentries and other redcoats were being yelled at by local people. Often as those sentries and redcoats tried to dodge snowballs, chunks of ice, stones, and brickbats being hurled at them by angry residents. In fact, we should probably also note that townsfolk sometimes even laid traps for British soldiers. One evening in June 1769, Private John Timmons, he's a British soldier, was at his sentry post when he heard cries. A woman shouting murder and a man's voice calling her a whore and telling her to shut up. Private Timmons rushed to intervene, disappearing down an alley in pursuit of the voices that he was hearing. Running around the corner, though, he is immediately set upon by three Boston wig makers who batter him with clubs, kick him, and drag him along the streets. Only the sounds of the approaching guard drive those wig makers off this poor sentry. It had been a setup. Now, the last two points I want to make about evolving patterns of friction and violence will, I think, help us to understand why the harassment and the violence I've described so far goes on for so long, beginning in the fall of 1768 and proceeding, as we'll see, all the way through 1769. So I want to note here that neither side was able to derive much satisfaction or redress from official channels. When soldiers accused townsfolk of starting something, local justice officials either refused to hear the case or declared testimony by soldiers to be inadmissible in their civilian courts. So the Boston authorities don't take soldiers' complaints that they've been entrapped, that they've been beaten, that they've been yelled at seriously. The Boston authorities do not respond positively to soldiers' complaints. Likewise, take the inverse. When townspeople succeeded in pressing charges against soldiers, the fines doled out by civilian courts to the redcoats usually go unpaid, as civilian courts have no mechanism to force uniformed soldiers of the British Empire to give up their cash. And as a result, a belief blossoms on both sides that there is no way to get justice without violence. The only thing to do if you've been affronted, violated, humiliated, harassed, is respond and give as good as you've got. An eye for an eye, etc. With no satisfaction possible in the courts, one incident would therefore just spark another, and then another, and then another, as a cycle of retaliation, a cycle of revenge ensued over time. Any questions about what I've just said? Although the British government decided to redeploy, to send elsewhere, two of the four regiments, to send them over to Ireland in June of 1769 to quell growing disorder there, two regiments remained in Boston beyond June of 1769, and skirmishes between townsfolk and those remaining soldiers continued to escalate, starting again in the fall of 1769. By the spring of 1770, Boston is in the grip of gang warfare in the streets. It's civilians versus soldiers, jets versus sharks. But notice what has not happened yet. By March the 1st, 1770, despite almost 18 months of rising tension, harassment, and violence since the arrival of the British troops in October 68, by March the 1st, 1770, not one of the British soldiers quartered in Boston has yet fired his weapon. Rocks have been thrown, yes. Men and women on both sides have been beaten, yes. Clubs, cudgels, and the butts of muskets have been used as weapons, yes. But not a single shot has yet been fired. And as we'll hear on Thursday, all that was about to change. That's all I'm going to say today. I'll remind you that if you want to read more about these topics, I always list the sources I use at the bottom of the presentation. Take a note that spots on the off-campus visits are filling up fast. If you'd like to go on one, please respond to my email of last week. And this time next week, we'll pass out in paper copy the first assignment. You'll have 2 weeks to do it. Thank you for being here today. Please stick around if you have questions. Thank you very much.
Next week on Lectures in History, University of Michigan professor Jonathan Marwill takes an in-depth look at how we remember the terrorist attacks of September 11th. Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. at midnight Eastern and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in History are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcasts. Or download them from iTunes.